It's Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, in the wake of the killing of 8 people in Atlanta, 6 of whom were Asian women, an historian explains the history of violence against people of Asian descent. First, COVID-19 has been especially tough on nursing homes and long-term care facilities. Last week, the Wisconsin Department of Health Services reclassified about 1,000 COVID-19 deaths as having occurred in those facilities. They now account for 45% of Wisconsin's deaths from the virus. But thanks to more senior citizens and healthcare workers getting vaccinated, there's some good news. In-person visits are coming back to many care facilities. Earlier this month, DHS recommended that visitors can be allowed back. And over the weekend, the city of Milwaukee eased its own restrictions on visitations. You're part of this conversation about COVID and long-term care. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Have you or a loved one spent the last year in a nursing home or an assisted living facility? What's the experience been like without being able to see family members or friends in person? Tell us what it's like. Call 800-642-1234. Share your story there, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Tatiana Shippey is an associate professor of health policy and management at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. She studies aging and quality of life in long-term care. Tatiana, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Such a pleasure to be here.
Wisconsin is recommending that care communities can open back up to visitors. Are we seeing that happen elsewhere around the country too?
We certainly are, and this is such good news. I know so many family members and residents who are desperately waiting for this to happen. And so on March 10th, as you mentioned, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid released new guidance, which now allow quote-unquote responsible in-person visitations in long-term care facilities. And I'm just thrilled that we're finally at this point in this very challenging year that we've had, that family members are allowed to go and see their loved ones in nursing homes. So yes, this is happening across the country. It's happening across in most states. Of course, there are some variations because there are some restrictions around having COVID positive residents in the facility, but certainly what's happening in Milwaukee is being mirrored across the nation.
Some leaders in long-term care facilities encountered pushback from people when they said, you can't come in, you can't visit your relatives, we'll help you with FaceTime or you can look out the window, but we can't have you in our facility. Was this a crucial step for nursing homes?
It is. And, you know, this is such a hard place to be because, when you know, something I'll mention about myself, I actually spent 2 years living in a long-term care facility for my doctorate work. And so during that time and all the work I've done in the last, you know, over a decade on quality of life, long-term care residents are already highly isolated when they are in nursing homes. And so when you add this inability to see their loved ones, of course, it is going to make it so much harder for their well-being and quality of life. But of course, nursing homes also, we're worried about spread in the facilities. And so I think now that we are finally seeing the decrease in community rates of spread of COVID, it's, you know, safe enough to be able to open long-term care facilities, but understandable why everybody was frustrated about it.
Because creating a sense of community, keeping up those connections is already challenging in, you know, normal times, pandemic, right? When visitors aren't allowed in, what effect have you seen that have on the lifestyle and the mental well-being of people in long-term care?
You know, a lot of my work involves working closely with residents in nursing homes and especially their family members. And certainly my team and I have heard, you know, so much angst and worry from family members who have loved ones in a nursing home whom they could not see. And so we also know just recently today, I saw a new article came out, which is documenting the impact of the isolation on measures of well-being. And what this article shows is, not surprisingly, that residents during the COVID lockdown who were not able to see their family members had increased in depression, again, not a surprise, increase in unplanned weight loss, as well as functional decline. And again, this is not surprising because COVID restrictions already limited what residents could do in the facility, right? They couldn't participate in activities. They couldn't leave their rooms for having meals and socialization. And so not being able to see their family members was yet another measure that had a negative, unfortunately, a negative impact on their well-being. And so I'm sure even more data will continue to come out that quantifies the effects of that social isolation.
Tatiana Shippey from the University of Minnesota's School of Public Health is our guest. She studies aging and quality of life in long-term care. And we're talking about the pandemic and skilled nursing facilities and other kinds of long-term care. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Taking your questions, and also we want to hear your experiences when it comes to long-term care and the pandemic. We've got Rick from Green Bay on the line to talk with us. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Yeah, I'm 65 years old. My father is 97, living at a local assisted living facility, and he remembers the day. It was just a little over a week ago that it was 1 year. And definitely it was a serious restriction on an already restricted lifestyle. I think so many components that I would love to talk about, just the isolation, already in an isolated place, the lack of care and the lack of payment for care, and the high costs that that are responsible that happen with nursing home care. But indeed, we are all looking forward to be able to visit with him again. There were the facility that he stays at is a very highly regarded one. We have great respect for them, but I talk with my dad every night, and he struggles with the loneliness and the lack of things to do, because at that age and other residents there are either restricted in some physical way, whether it be memory, whether it be able to speak or able to listen or able to see or able to move. And I just think that we are not, as a society, it's another one of those issues that's brought forth by this pandemic, that we're not recognizing the care that we're in.
And Rick, thank you so much for sharing your experience and also speaking and helping us understand what it's like for your father. You know, Rick mentioned that loneliness. And I wonder, Tatiana, can isolation have an impact on our physical health too?
Yes. And I also just want to echo, you know, thank you, Rick, for calling. And you brought up so many issues there, yeah, about isolation and, as you said already, isolated environment. Yes, we have a preponderance of studies which show quantifiable effects of social isolation on physical well-being. And that includes, you know, a number of different health outcomes, including heart disease, you know, premature mortality. As I noted, the study that just came out today, functional decline, weight loss, cognitive ability. And so, you know, you think about, again, nursing homes are not meant to be places where people live out for a long period of time, as we find a lot of people, their last home. And so we really need to think, how do we make nursing homes more stimulating, more engaging? How do we, for people like Rick's dad, how can we build meaningful social engagement that makes it, you know, still a place that stimulates and fosters some social connection for him and other residents? But absolutely, lots of evidence on physical effects of social isolation.
One of the things we've had to recognize about this pandemic is that we've seen racial disparities when it comes to both cases and deaths from COVID-19. Have we seen something similar with people in long-term care facilities?
We have, unfortunately. Much of my work focuses on racial equity in long-term care. And what we have found, and this information started to come out early on in the pandemic. In fact, my team penned an article before we had the data where we said, based on everything we know, all the work we've done on racial disparities in quality of life and quality of care, we were very concerned about the disparities we would see with this pandemic, because really all that has done is has just exacerbated existing disparities. And sure enough, as the data started to come in, we see that nursing home residents of color, so Black, Indigenous, and other residents of color compared to their white peers, have been 2 to 3 times more likely to die from COVID and much more likely to have COVID infections compared to their white peers. So that has been a very frustrating and disappointing additional layer of disparity that we have seen in COVID for people who are already so vulnerable, you know, being in a nursing home, much higher likelihood of mortality from COVID.
Can we pinpoint what causes those disparities?
Such a challenging question, but what my work has shown and that of a number of others is that, in fact, long-term care is the most racially segregated aspect of the healthcare industry, So what we see is that, for example, Black individuals are much more likely to cluster in certain types of facilities, in part based on access, you know, geographic availability. And often these are the facilities that are for-profit facilities, large facilities that have low staffing rates and lack the resources to adequately care for their residents. So that's just one of the explanations for the disparity.
Our guest is Tatiana Shippey with the University of Minnesota's School of Public Health. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about nursing homes and other care facilities in the pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you know someone who's been living in a care facility during the pandemic? Has it been difficult not to be able to see them in person? Maybe you've been able to have a socially distanced visit with them. What was that like? Call 800-642-1234 or share your story by emailing ideas@wpr.org. Our conversation continues. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking about the ways the pandemic has affected life and policies in long-term care facilities like nursing homes. Tatiana Shippey is our guest. She's an associate professor of health policy and management at the University of Minnesota's School of Public Health. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think the last year shows that something needs to change in our approach to long-term care? What problems do you see? What solutions do you see? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Kate from Barneveld wants to share with us. Hey, Kate.
Hi. Thanks so much for having this topic. It's a very important one right now. I'll try to share my story briefly and without crying. I had a mother who experienced a fall at the very beginning of COVID, and she ended up being placed in a rehab facility, a short-term rehab facility. Due to COVID, that time ended up extending, and she was eventually... They were not even allowing their residents window visits, which was just appalling to me, to think that that facility's inconvenience would dictate, you know, them not even being able to have a loved one visit through a window. And I watched my mom go from someone who was experiencing some cognitive confusion and frailty, go from a woman who took great joy in seeing her family and delight in the small things in life to being very confused, lonely, terrified, not knowing what was happening to her. And she physically and cognitively declined so fast and you know, right in front of us, though we couldn't be right in front of her. So, and she did end up passing away more suddenly, I'm convinced, than she would have. I consider her a casualty of COVID, even though she did not get COVID. And I feel that this needs to make us take a really, really hard look at whether we value quantity over quality.
Yeah, Kate. I'm so sorry for your loss, and I really want to thank you for being willing to share that story with us, because I know it's a really hard one to share. And Tatiana, what about what Kate said at the end after telling us about what she saw happen with her mom, this idea of balancing quality of life with quantity, especially when it comes to long-term care? These are tough decisions.
Yes, and my heart just breaks for your loss as well, Kate. I'm so sorry to hear about it. And likely what you are saying would be supported by data, because, you know, what I have, and I really appreciate you having this conversation as well, because, you know, during my time living in long-term care facility, and as all of my research shows, really based on what residents have told me, residents in the nursing homes have told me that we need to be treated as people first and patients second. And much of that has been tied to thinking about them, yes, individuals who have dignity, who need to have meaningful engagement, who need to have consistency and relationships, as we would for anybody else, right? And so I think this story illustrates, again, the effects of COVID beyond mortality in terms of the physical conditions that we've seen, but the social isolation, loneliness, especially for individuals who are already vulnerable, who might have some cognitive loss, I mean, I am sure that if we were to quantify it, we would see that the numbers are much higher than what we're seeing now. And of course, the heartache, the pain of loss for family members and caregivers who are not able to be there. So it's just a really, really tough story. And I think it gets to how we deliver long-term care in this country, and which is, you know, a really complex picture. But I am hopeful that something comes out of this great challenge and tragedy we've been through, that we'll see some changes happening systemically.
Long-term care facilities were particularly hard hit by COVID-19 specifically. I mean, here in Wisconsin, the Department of Health Services, we talked about, recently reclassified about 1,000 COVID-19 deaths as coming from those facilities. That's making up close to half of the state's death from the virus now. Looking back over this year, how severe a toll has this been for long-term care?
Again, probably even an underestimate with the numbers you've listed, you know, with the information we're hearing coming out, I bet that the toll, again, has even been greater. But we know that on average, about 42% or higher of deaths in the U.S. Nationally have been in long-term care facilities. So just brutally devastating effect, again, for people who are most vulnerable in our society. And I'm sure, you know, many of your listeners could think of reasons for that, right? Multiple people sharing rooms and staffing. But I would also say, I just want to call attention and think through the effect for staff who work in long-term care facilities. I know for a while, we were not really hearing information on mortality for staff. And then we started to get data and saw that the deaths for long-term care staff in nursing homes were exceedingly high. And in fact, many of those staff are also, you know, women and staff of color. And so the effect has been multi-pronged, and it has been on residents and staff, and of course on family members of those residents who lost their loved ones.
We're talking with Tetiana Shippey, who's an associate professor of health policy and management at the University of Minnesota's School of Public Health. And we're talking about COVID-19 and what's happened in long-term care facilities across the country and here in Wisconsin. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Tetiana, what are we seeing right now in terms of vaccinations for people in nursing homes and care facilities? I mean, is this really what has changed the dynamic in these long-term care homes?
Yes, and I'm so happy to see these trends. It's just so, so encouraging. In a recent Kaiser Family Foundation report and other data sources have shown that cases, that COVID-positive cases have plummeted 83% down among nursing home staff, and similar numbers among nursing home residents, 89% among residents, 83% among staff, much higher, far outpacing the proportion in the general public. And it's just so encouraging to see that the vaccination is making the positive impact that we were hoping it would. And I know there was a lot of concern and still remains to be about vaccine access and hesitancy among long-term care staff. And so I was very encouraged to see this recent data that even despite the vaccine hesitancy among some of the long-term care staff, we've seen a decline of, you know, 83% in COVID positive cases among staff. So yes, great news, really strong numbers. I mean, every time I've been looking at charts, you see the trends going down in terms of positivity rate and mortality from COVID nationally in long-term care facilities. And that's exactly what we want to see. So I hope we can keep it up. And I know a few days ago, we had about 3 million doses of COVID vaccines were administered in long-term care facilities. And I hope we can see that number keep going up.
Do you see disparities in vaccine access in nursing homes the same way that we do in the general population?
You know, that's a really good question. I don't actually have the data on it. I do know that there were concerns and some data about access for long-term care staff from communities of color in terms of getting access to vaccine, and that, you know, the different priorities differ by state. So, for example, you know, in Minnesota, they were in our first tier, but that's not the same across other states. I don't have the exact data on the vaccine access specifically for long-term care facilities, but that would be something to keep an eye on. But again, very encouraged by the general downward trend.
And certainly something that I'm sure people are looking at as we move out of the acute devastation of the pandemic and get closer to the ability to actually look back on it instead of living through it. I want to fit in one more caller now. Prairie from Lone Rock is ready to talk with us. Hi, Prairie.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to encourage people to think about caring for their elderly family, aging family members in their home, and that we need to try and put public resources towards making that possible. My 96-year-old grandmother's lived with us for the past couple of years, and it has not been easy always, but especially over this last year, we have been really grateful, but both for herself and for our own family. We have young children also that we've been able to have her here with us. And I know that not everybody's able to do that. It's a difficult thing, but I think if, you know, we look at what we spend in public money on putting folks in nursing homes where, you know, if we could spend some of that money on getting them into situations where they could arguably be with people who are able to care for and care for them and love them, that it would really have a drastically different effect on quality of life.
Prairie, thank you so much for bringing that up. So Prairie here talking about more, you know, at-home care. Tatiana, that among other things, what's one way after you look at the last year or so that you think we could change long-term health care for our senior citizens to make it more effective, more accessible?
Yeah, and really appreciate your last caller's perspectives too. You know, a couple of things. In fact, what we have seen in the last year, but also that trend started earlier, is the increase in the multi-generational households. So similar to what your caller was referring to. And also we see more and more investment, and COVID has only kind of fastened that trend among states across the nation into home and community-based services for individuals. So people receiving care at home instead of institutional settings. What I will say, though, is, you know, moving forward, how do we reimagine long-term care in this country? I think everybody agrees, seeing what's happened in nursing homes, is that something needs to change. And, you know, unfortunately, not everybody can have their loved one in their own home. And so I think we need different kinds of care settings, and we need to be able to enable people to receive care at home with Medicaid and other supports, and also support their caregivers to be able to do that if they are able to provide that care, but also create opportunities for people to, if they need to, receive care in residential settings that have proper staffing, right? We've seen support for staff is vital. Pay for staff is so important. And how care is delivered. You know, for example, My own research shows that activity staff are so important for quality of life. So how do we make those investments going forward?
And Tatiana, we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for this conversation.
Tatiana Shippey with the University of Minnesota's School of Public Health. Coming up after the news, we take a look at the long history of anti-Asian discrimination and violence in the U.S. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on the morning show, the race for Wisconsin's top education job is down to a superintendent from a rural school district near Madison and a former superintendent from a Milwaukee suburb. Hear from both Jill Underley and Deb Kerr ahead of the April election. That's tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Last week, a man killed 8 people at 3 different spas in Atlanta, Georgia. 6 of those people were women of Asian descent. Authorities haven't said that the killings were racially motivated, and they noted that the shooter said his sex addiction was the reason for the crime. Many people of Asian descent have criticized that conclusion, pointing to the spike in violence against Asian Americans in the last year and the connections between violence against Asian women, misogyny, and racism. There's a long history in the United States of discrimination against people of Asian descent, stretching back to the mid-19th century when Chinese immigrants first came to America. We're learning about the history of anti-Asian discrimination and violence. Cindy Yifeng Chang is a professor of history and Asian American studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's also the author of Citizens of Asian America, Democracy and Race During the Cold War. Cindy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
This country is seeing increased violence against people of Asian descent. According to one study from California State University San Bernardino, anti-Asian crimes have increased 150% since the start of the pandemic. What have you noticed in the last year?
I definitely noticed an increase in the reported amount of violence that has occurred. But I think as we note, that the pandemic has created a lot of economic duress amongst many people. And in these moments, I think we've seen, once again, a real increase in the kind of level of verbal assaults and physical attacks against Asian Americans.
Do we know why this is happening?
I think for many of this, if we wanted to relate it to the shooting in particular, right? As you were mentioning in the start of this, the programming, you start to see that there's a recent history that we see, right, of U.S. military engagement in South Korea, in the Philippines, and in Vietnam. In these areas with a lot of U.S. soldiers, there's usually next to it a military camp town where economically disenfranchised Asian women would have to work as sex workers. Sometimes they are called military comfort women. And this creates a particular kind of stereotype of women, Asian women, as sexually available. And this kind of assumption carries over to the United States here. So this kind of relationship between Asian women, quote unquote, sex work, has been kind of something that's quite prominent following the Korean War and the war in Vietnam. And you start to see this kind of association such that the shooter went to three different locations in two different counties in a state that has 4% Asian Americans. In Atlanta, there's 4.4% Asian Americans, something that you have to search for. They're quite a minority group, right? You really start to see this kind of stereotyping of Asian women play out. And so I think for this, it's very much, as you say, something that is very interrelated between race, between gender, and between a particular kind of misogynistic behavior.
Authorities said that the shooter was motivated by a sex addiction. Let's hear some of that.
He does claim that it was not racially motivated. He apparently has an issue, what he considers a sex addiction, and sees these locations as a temptation for him that he wanted to eliminate.
So this really connects back to what you were just saying. We've heard experts speak out and say that there are these connections between violence against Asian women, misogyny, and anti-Asian racism. Talk more about that.
Yes. We also, as you noted, that this type of anti-Asian sentiment that we are seeing spike during the pandemic, right, where a particular neutral term that we have assumed, something like, you know, calling the virus, let's say China virus, implies a sense of neutral term that we're just indicating where the virus, one of its originating points. The reason I say one is that many of us have relatives and friends that we know who have tested positive, and they certainly didn't travel to Wuhan, China to get it. There's many different points of contact, but scientists believe that it did originate in Wuhan, that it has this neutral geographic term. We see that being used as a particular kind of stigma, right, against China in a trade war, against people of Asian descent in the United States, in a way to denigrate them as a verbal assault, to intimidate them. We see these types of anti-Asian spike during this time. And that the current situation, as you're asking me to talk about, is what we have said is historically rooted. One context that I had spoken about, again, is about the kind of U.S. military culture, right, of sex worker camp towns. There are other major incidences throughout U.S. history, right? One of the key things that many people are very aware of is the Chinese Exclusion Act. A lot of times in my classroom, when we have more time, the bigger context that we study is that prior to the passage of the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, there was another federal policy called the Page Act, 1875, that was to bar the immigration of Chinese women to the United States because it was assumed, right, it's that stereotype that all Chinese women were prostitutes. And while it was not federally enforced, right, 1882, Chinese became the first federally enforced immigration restriction in the United States. The question we ask is, why? What was so important about restricting women, Chinese women, and restricting Chinese workers, right? Why is the relationship between race and gender completely interrelated, right? And the question is that although the popular thing that we say is that Chinese exclusion is because there is a racial scapegoating during economic time, instead of looking at different industries.
Cindy, I can't hear you anymore.
We also see that. Oh, sorry. Can you hear me right now?
I think we just had a bit of a blip. Go ahead. Please continue.
Yes. We start to see that a lot of times when we talk about Chinese exclusion, we say that we focus on the labor aspect, right? That in economic recession, we don't look at industries and what they are, the policies that they have imposed, government policies to create recession. We look at the workers and we say, it's that immigrant worker that stole my job. But we also start to see during the same time, there is this belief that interracial coupling between white men and Chinese women was polluting, right? At that time, there was a belief that these kinds of interracial intimacies would pollute the white blood. And so from a very early on, the first ever immigration restriction, right, was already against both women and workers of Asian descent. So I think this thing that we're starting to see has a longer history, but it's definitely rooted in very recent histories as well.
We're talking with Cindy Ethan Chang, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you Asian American? How did you react to the shootings in Atlanta, from hearing what the motivations of the shooter were to the reality that six of the eight people killed were Asian women? How do you feel about the fact that these haven't been categorized as racially motivated? What's your experience like? 800-642-1234 is the number to call to share your story. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Cindy, I think that's what's so striking about this, what you just mentioned, saying that it's rooted way back in history, but also in recent history. I mean, in listening to you, you've gone from the 1850s to the 1870s and then into the 1900s. I mean, there are layers here of acts that have restricted Asian Americans in this country.
Yes. And I think that this is what we're starting to see is a time, you know, I know it goes back to very basic fundamental understandings about the power of stereotypes, right? Is that what stereotypes do is that it creates generalization and it reduces the complexity, the humanity of a group of people into one or two characteristics. What you start to see in this particular kind of way we've talked about sexual addiction, how it's connected, right, is that you start to see that there was a generalization, a stereotype of the availability of Asian women as sex workers. And instead of looking at them as complex people who are economically disenfranchised, that they had to work as essential workers during a pandemic, who are vulnerable, who have sons to support, who have families, who are people who are they're economically responsible for other lives, that they have to work. They're part of the essential workers of our pandemic. Instead of looking at the complexities of who they are, they get reduced into this one or two characteristics as quote unquote sex workers. And I think many people would have issue in terms of a particular kind of social stigma against sex workers, against people who have to work for a living, and would just, you know, go around again. This is very intentional, picking three different areas in two different counties in a state with very, very small Asian American population. This is very targeted, and that it reduces the complexities of these people into this one stereotype about Asian American women in particular. And I think it's also really important to note that the leading South Korean daily, their leading newspaper of the country, interviewed eyewitnesses who escaped this rampage. And they heard him say that he was going to kill all the Asians. And I would also think it's important for law. I'm curious to see how our law enforcement, if they actually went and interviewed these eyewitnesses, because it's reported all over Korean media. It is reported all over Korean media. And throughout history, we start to see the power of stereotypes, right? Of how, again, the complexities of groups of people gets reduced to one or two things, that they become easy targets of verbal attacks and physical assault.
Cindy Ifan Chang is a professor of history and Asian American studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we're talking about a rise in violence against people of Asian descent in the United States. We are taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you want people to understand about racism? Have you been discriminated against? We've seen hate crime spike after different events in history. What do you remember about those times? What do you want people to understand? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. The conversation continues here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're going over the history of discrimination and violence against people of Asian descent with UW-Madison Professor Cindy Ifan Chang. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. You can also send us a tweet at Central Time WPR. Cindy, one moment in history we haven't talked about in the last, 170 years is what happened with Japanese Americans and Japanese immigrants during the Second World War here in America. How has internment shaped American history and then, you know, the lives of Asian Americans even today?
Yes, and I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's also a very, really great example that ties to the recent Atlanta shooting. And what we start to see in Japanese incarceration during World War II is that a particular situation between Japan and the United States changed in World War II. Japan became the enemy of the United States with the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And what happens is when a particular political or economic situation between the U.S. and an Asian country change, there's always a lingering question: should it or does it impact the lives of Asians in the United States? And the fact that it does shows that for Asians, no matter how many generations they've been in the United States, whether they were born here or not, there's always this perception that they're foreign. They're not really quite American. And what we start to see is that the loyalties of Japanese Americans, two-thirds of those who were incarcerated were in fact American-born, were immediately perceived as foreign. And this gets to what we talked about in terms of racial stereotyping. They are, again, perceived, not the complexity of the humanity. Like, we did not go case by case. The reason we see it as a racial issue and not just national security is, no matter who you are, if you have Japanese descent, you were incarcerated. We didn't give them trial. We didn't do it. We just wholesale blanketly incarcerated 120,000 Japanese and Japanese Americans in the United States from the Pacific Coast. And we also think this is really important because we compare it with other ethnic groups, Germans and Italians. Germany and Italy were also powers that the United States was, at war with. And while some German Americans and Italian Americans definitely got their loyalties questioned, it wasn't this entire wholesale mass incarceration, such that kids, babies were also similarly interned. So I think what we start to see in terms of Asian American situation is that when there are changing circumstances, like right now, there's a trade war between US and China, there's a pandemic that originated in Wuhan, immediately there is a suspicion against Asians in the United States, verbal assaults. And this leads Asian Americans to question, like, no matter how many generations they are in the United States, born or not, can they belong? Is the color line that strong, right? Are they always going to be perceived as foreigners? And so I think this is, this is what a lot of these kinds of anti-Asian attacks make us think about.
We're talking with Cindy Ifan Chang, who is a professor of history and Asian American studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we are talking about the rise of violence against Asian Americans here. And we've got Carol in Madison ready to talk with us. Hi, Carol.
Hi, I just wanted to say that the white supremacy and xenophobia has always been an ugly underbelly in the United States. But I believe our former despicable president let those cockroaches out from under the rocks and from the wood, and we have him to blame. I put the recent attacks on Asians squarely on his shoulders for the despicable remarks he made about China and the COVID-19 virus.
Okay, Carol, thanks for that input there. And while former President Donald Trump is not specifically responsible for this, I do wonder, to Carol's point, how much what our leaders say matters. How much of this, Cindy, is about the messaging? And if our elected officials take a hard line against white supremacy, against discrimination against any people of color, Asian Americans, how much of a difference does that make when this is systematic and historical?
Excellent question. And thank you, Carol, for that remark. I mean, I think the history of, as you say, of xenophobia and of racism in the United States, it cannot necessarily be on any one person's shoulder. It's obviously something that is historically rooted. However, what you point out is absolutely important in that there are people that have greater power, greater visibility, a much more bigger platform. And how they conduct themselves, their sense of character, what comes out, they start to represent ideas of who we are as a nation. And I think to, very casually mock and refer to this particular virus as a China virus, in a way to mock China, in a way to denigrate a particular group of people, that definitely will impact people. It will empower people to think that's actually okay. And once again, they can hide under the cloak of this is a neutral term referring to some geographic area where this virus originated. However, the way it's directed, the stigma that it thinks, how it allows and has increased a particular tense environment, how it encourages attacks, verbal assaults against Asian Americans. That's, we are living in the time when we are seeing concrete evidence arise in reported violence. This particular mass shooting, that there's a serious racial issue here. And we need leaders who's going to take a stand against racism and xenophobia.
Do you think that matters? Do you think if our leaders unequivocally say this is unacceptable, that will help us get on a better course?
I hope so, because I hope that they translate their political rhetoric into institutional change. Because for us to really get at eradicating these kinds of racism, we have to talk about the inequities that this pandemic has shown in terms of housing, in terms of healthcare, in terms of food, and in terms of making ends meet. And we have to talk about all these things that's interrelated. Can people afford decent housing? Can people afford to get by month to month? I mean, all these important things. I mean, it's not just a simple thing of a tweet or a rhetoric. It has to be manifest in deep material changes, deep institutional fixes. And we have to be as a nation committed to that.
Cindy, thank you. Thank you so much for your time and helping us to put this into context.
Thank you so much for having me.
Cindy Efen Chang is a professor of history and Asian American studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a bill that would allow immigrant farm workers to apply for legal status in the U.S. passed the House last week with bipartisan support. We'll talk about that and the role migrant labor plays in Wisconsin's dairy industry. Plus, we have a discussion about how education has changed for good thanks to the pandemic, those conversations and much more tomorrow on Central Time. A woman from Madison, Wisconsin, has returned a library book that was just a bit overdue. She checked it out about 63 years ago. Betty Diamond was a 10-year-old growing up in Queens when she borrowed a book called Old Paul the Mighty Logger. It's a collection of Paul Bunyan tales. Betty says she was too ashamed to take an overdue library book back as a kid, so she kept it. Then it got lost in the shuffle of life. She'd notice it occasionally, but she just couldn't make herself deal with the issue. So Betty got her PhD in English from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She also taught literature at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. And now, at age 74, Betty said it was time to make amends. She sent the library book back about 23,000 days late, along with a $500 donation to the Queens Public Library. Turns out that more than covers the late fees. A lot of people have learned about Betty and her book. Wonder what she thinks of all the attention she's getting? Tune in on Wednesday and you can hear from Betty herself right here on Central Time. Coming up next, it is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Keeley Boltina. This is Central Time, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.